The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the books section of the May 20th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Class Consciousness for Billionaires. We used to think the rich had a social function. What are they good for now? By Benjamin Wallace Wells. Around the start of the 21st century, the Oxford sociologist Jonathan Gershuni noticed a change in the way the privileged behaved. The leisure class that the economist Thorsten Veblen had described during the Gilded Age seemed no longer to exist. The farther up people were on the income ladder, the harder they worked. Busyness, Gershuni concluded, was the badge of honor for the new superordinate working class. These days, even the highest-profile billionaires tend to be a little grim-faced. Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, they practice judo throws, but do they ever smile? Recently, the Wall Street Journal reported on the minting of a new mega-billionaire, the 86-year-old Texas wildcatter Autry Stevens, who, in February, sold his company and its meticulously assembled Permian drilling rights for $26 billion. Stevens had driven to his office every day for 45 years, lately in an old Toyota Land Cruiser. Was he looking forward to enjoying his extraordinary gains? Not really. He would miss the grind. "There is certainly some sadness on my part," Stevens said. Why work this hard? Doesn't a life of ease beckon? Aren't there polo ponies to raise? The traditional rationale is to provide comforts to those you love. Familia id est substantia, the 15th and 16th century Southern European jurist argued. In other words, the family is the patrimony. But at Stevens' level, the logic dissolves. No family needs the $26 billion. In the early 20th century, the Texas oil tycoon Haroldson L. Hunt, then one of the richest men in the world, remarked that, for practical purposes, someone who has $200,000 a year is as well off as I am. As he explained, money's just a way of keeping score. It's the game that matters. That game, the competition among the ultra-wealthy for influence, legacy, and fortune, came to seem somewhat more sinister after the Great Recession steepened social inequality. Following the lead of Thomas Piketty, whose Capital in the 21st Century was published in 2013, some like-minded scholars probed the distant past, seeking to learn how deeply ingrained inequality had been in societies dissimilar to our own. As Gods Among Men, A History of the Rich in the West, published by Princeton, a new book by the Italian historian Guido Alfani shares these scholars' political perspective and their emphasis on the extremely long arc. But Alfani is interested less in the patterns of inequality than in the assemblage, use, and justification of great fortunes. The anxieties about extreme wealth, which have recently shaped public debate, regarding its influence on politics, the way it tests the reach of states, and the ethics of philanthropy and private investment, turn out to be extraordinarily old. The rich have confused the rest of us from the beginning. When, in northern Italy, on the cusp of the Renaissance, something like the modern mogul emerged, urban, financial, ostensibly meritocratic. Many members of society were troubled by the very existence of the rich, Alfani writes. Indeed, it would not be too far-fetched to state that they did not know precisely what to do with them. In the more recent past, the super-rich themselves often dealt with the social problems of wealth simply by declining to discuss them. The only time a whale gets harpooned is when he surfaces. The reticent billionaire investor David Gottesman told the Times a decade ago. But lately, whales have been surfacing everywhere. This past winter alone, the plutocrats Mark Rowan and Bill Ackman campaigned very publicly to remove the presidents of Penn and Harvard, and the investor Jeffrey Yass sought to have the Republican Party reverse itself on the sale of TikTok, in which he had a stake. The defining billionaire of the moment is Elon Musk. Not just because of his trolling presence on social media, but because of his salvific ambitions. Projects such as Sam Bankman-Fried's cryptocurrency and effective altruism initiatives and Sam Altman's simultaneous warnings about and development of artificial intelligence carry with them a similar imprint. For-profit maneuvers are described in the language of an encompassing idealism, as if those people in charge were envisioning not Q3 returns, but the future of humanity itself. As revelations of inequality have kept the spotlight on the wealthy, some of them, notably the heiress and philanthropist Abigail Disney, have argued for greater public giving. It's taxes or pitchforks, a worried coalition wrote in an open letter released as the World Economic Forum convened in Davos in 2022. Those are the liberals. The more audible reaction has been a bristling insistence that the super rich deserve their outsized fortune. Our enemy is anti-merit, anti-ambition, anti-striving, anti-achievement, and anti-greatness, Mark Andreessen wrote in his Techno-Optimist Manifesto, widely applauded in Silicon Valley last fall. Speaking before the global elite at Davos this January, Javier Milei, the libertarian president of Argentina, declared, "Let no one tell you your ambition is immoral. You are social benefactors. You are heroes." Musk himself tweeted an enthusiastic reply by way of a meme. A man having sex with an attractive woman stares at a laptop screen on which Milei is speaking. Critics of the ultra-wealthy have tended to describe them with analogies from the animal kingdom. Pigs at a trough. Vampire squid. Alfani offers a gentler comparison. They are like the pearl in the oyster, shiny indeed, and produced by the living body of the oyster, but at the same time somewhat extraneous to the organism, he writes. The question that animates his book also haunts our politics. What exactly do we want the rich to do, and how do we want them to be? In the beginning, the job was to plunder and protect. Wealth lay in land, and in medieval Europe, one amassed and held land by force of arms. In 1066, a Breton nobleman named Alan Rufus crossed the English Channel with his second cousin, William the Conqueror, whose left flank he'd helped hold in a crucial battle. For this, he was granted a broad portfolio of lands in Cambridgeshire, many of which had belonged to the vanquished queen, Edith the Fair. But that was just the beginning of Rufus's path to immense wealth, Alfani writes. Soon, there was a rebellion in York, and Rufus was summoned to help suppress it, which he did in a brutal campaign that is thought to have killed as many as 100,000 people. The territories given to him grew and grew until, Alfani reports, their net revenue may have exceeded 7% of England's. No Englishman has ever again controlled such a large share. Within a couple of hundred years, however, the richest Europeans were increasingly emerging not from real estate, but from commerce and finance. The epicenter was northern Italy, where the traders of the so-called commercial revolution had followed old Roman caravan routes into the Middle East. Returning to Genoa, Ragusa, and Pisa, laden with goods, and where innovative Italian bankers had developed double-entry bookkeeping, letters of credit, and bills of exchange, in part to help manage papal taxes flowing from across Christendom to the Vatican. When the English crown fought the Hundred Years' War, it did so on credit extended by two Florentine family banks. When the Habsburgs wanted to unify their empire, they contracted with Francesco Tasso of Bergamo to create a postal service. By the early 16th century, a package sent from Brussels could reach Innsbruck in 5 days. These changes aroused the philosophers. Theologians emphasized the unnaturalness of finance. Numus non potet numos, Thomas Aquinas insisted. Money does not generate money. As they approached their deathbeds, usury was not a but the sin on the minds of the wealthy. Tim Parks wrote in Medici Money, published in 2006, objections to the source of banking fortunes were intertwined with concerns about their scale. Nicole Oresme, an advisor to Charles V of France, argued in the 1370s that the rich ought to be banished to preserve the social balance in democratically governed cities. The superabundantes are so unequal and exceed and overcome the others regarding their political power so much that it is reasonable to think that they are among the others as God is among men. In the letters that the Renaissance wealthy wrote one another, there are traces of anxiety that both God and the public might disapprove of what they are doing. An associate of the fantastically rich Florentine merchant, Francesco Dattini, warns him against opening a bank, arguing that he will be disdained even if he leaves the bulk of his fortune to found a hospital for the poor, and that he will lose his buona fama, his good name. The hinge figure in Alfani's history is Cosimo de' Medici, who offered one solution to the problem of the rich. The Rome branch of the Banco de' Medici already held the Vatican's deposits when Cosimo took over the bank in 1420, and he lent cautiously, married strategically, and expanded relentlessly. Parks writes, "Nothing in the history books gives us the sense of the man's ever having been young. In time, Cosimo antagonized the Florentine landowning dynasty headed by Rinaldo degli Albizzi, in part because of Cosimo's financial ties to rival Italian republics. When Cosimo opposed a war with the state of Lucca, which the Albizzi family had pushed for, Rinaldo angled to have Cosimo imprisoned and charged with treason, punishable by death in 1433. Cosimo managed to have his sentence commuted to exile and took his banking operations and his favorite architect, Michelozzo, to Venice, giving the city a monastery with a new library and building for himself a spectacular palazzo. Within a year, the Albizzi War proved disastrous, and Florence was in financial ruin. It was a good time to have a phenomenal amount of cash. Cosimo agreed to pay off the Florentine war debt, and as Niccolò Machiavelli wrote a century later, he was hailed as the benefactor of the people and the father of his country. During the next 30 years, Cosimo schemed and maneuvered, holding power, deflecting allegations that he was a sponsor of sodomites, and beheading his political enemies, including two cousins of Machiavelli's father. But he also endowed. He sponsored the Council of Florence in 1438 to reconcile the Roman and Byzantine churches, and he built the Platonic Academy and the Medici Library, likely the first public library in Renaissance Europe. Among his public relations agents was the Tuscan scholar Poggio Bracciolini, once his tutor, whose view of the two roles the rich could play matched Cosimo's example. They could beautify the city through philanthropy, Poggio wrote, and they could supply barns of money to rescue it from a crisis. With their abundant means to aid the sick, the weak, to benefit many in their needs, the rich were the nervous system of the city. You could not function without them. But the wealthy men of early modern Europe didn't act much like Poggio had envisioned. Florence was an exception, both in its republican politics and in its humanist splendor. Great fortunes were still often made through ambition and cunning at court. The indebted 16th century privateer Francisco Pizarro held the Incan emperor Atahualpa hostage for a ransom of 85 cubic meters of gold and twice as much silver. A tawapa paid. Pizarro killed him anyway, and used the money to buy political influence in Spain and a South American empire for his brother. In the late 17th century, the French merchant Antoine Corzat won a place at court through his loans to the crown. His sons exploited the position to make advantageous loans to other nobles, and eventually secured the crown's monopoly on trade in the Louisiana Territory. These were tempestuous centuries, with the social order regularly restructured, but Alfani seems little interested in political change, acknowledging the French Revolution and Karl Marx only in passing. He emphasizes instead the constant pattern of dynastic entrenchment. However much creativity and innovation were required to build the massive number of wealthy dynasties spawned during industrialization, he writes, those fortunes often quickly took a different direction after the founders had passed away, for example, by pursuing politics and high office or merging with the nobility. Give the Musk and Andreessen families a single generation, his account suggests, and their fortunes will be no more justifiable than that of the rentiers, which could help explain why present-day billionaires so want to demonstrate how hard they are working. Historically, some of this entrenchment happened almost naturally. In 18th century Holland, the riches that arrived following a broad colonial and commercial expansion entirely upended the economic order, whereupon the insurgents swiftly became oligarchs. Within a generation, 83% of Rotterdam city councillors were a close relation to one another. At other times, the dynastic entrenchment was engineered. Of the 18 marriages entered into by the grandchildren of Meyer Amschel Rothschild, 16 were between an uncle and a niece or between first cousins. That the politics of wealth are irreducibly the politics of inherited wealth was once much more obvious in Europe than in the United States. In 1910, a little more than half of the largest American fortunes derived primarily from inheritance, whereas in most European countries, the figure was about 75%. Then, after the shocks of the 1930s and the Second World War, those positions flipped. By the mid-20th century, the inheritance share of wealth was higher in the U.S. than in Europe. Perhaps because of the scale of fortunes that arose in America, or because of our explicitly democratic covenants, the rich here have tended to wrestle more directly with the contradictions of their position. There was the model of Andrew Carnegie, exploiting his workers while worrying over the possibility of a rigid caste system and establishing public libraries to help alleviate it. Then there was Jay Gould, who denied that there was anything to apologize for and forewent philanthropy in favor of building a railroad empire and marrying his daughter into the French nobility. What really are the rich supposed to do with their fortunes? They can spend their money lavishly, which everyone agrees is profligate and gross, or they can save it, which deepens inequality and is probably worse. Whatever they do, the rich attract criticism, Alfani writes. In the case of the robber barons, it took until 1907 for that criticism to break their system. The immediate cause was a failed effort by a trio of Montana magnates to corner the market on copper. When their position was exposed, there was a run on one of the banks that had backed them, the third largest trust on Wall Street, which soon collapsed. Very quickly, the brokerages and banks linked to the principals in the copper escapade came under threat, too. J.P. Morgan convened a coalition of the wealthy who plowed in their own cash to stop the run and perhaps saved the banking system. He had repeated Cosimo's trick. But this time, the public was appalled at the influence that a few plutocrats could have. After some antagonistic hearings, a progressive Congress created the Federal Reserve, henceforth the barns of money would be much larger, and everyone would contribute, not just the ultra-wealthy. Since the Renaissance, the rich had had two roles. Now they were down to one, charity. In the past generation, the ranks of the super-rich have grown dramatically. Between 1990 and 2020, the number of billionaires in the U.S. increased ninefold. In China, the growth of the super-wealthy has been more explosive still. In a single year, between 2020 and 2021, that country's billionaire count grew by 60%. Private fortunes of this scale are fundamentally transnational and less moored to individual nations that might make demands of them. Consultancies now track the movement of high net worth individuals across borders. Almost 11,000 left China in 2022 alone. If the 2010s were the decade of tax offshoring, the 2020s are the era of the Singapore family office, private investment and philanthropy hubs for vast fortunes. Progressives, for much of the past century, have seen the problem of wealth through the lens of redistribution. What they want of the rich is that they pay their fair share. Taxes are the proper way, institutionally and culturally, for the rich to contribute to society, Alfani concludes. Not giving, but taxes. This can seem a little quaint and unadventurous. But in this jittery, politically tenuous post-pandemic period, the sentiment has weakened. Throughout the pandemic, at a time when public resources were under strain and aggressive emergency aid for the poor made for an immediate reduction to inequality, no advanced economy, with the exception of Spain, meaningfully raised taxes on the rich. The idea that the rich could have a role as a class is more than a little antiquated. Jeff Bezos and Abigail Disney have very different abilities, powers, and insights. We shouldn't want them to do the same thing. But Alfani's observation that the rich as a group have no clear social function is borne out by the fact that, in the Musk era, they have reacted to populist pressures largely by justifying their fortunes as individuals. When they maintain a combative social media presence, fixate on meritocracy, employ idealistic language to describe for-profit enterprises, and draw attention to their heroic personal labors, the aim isn't to rationalize concentrations of wealth generally, but to defend one pile of wealth specifically. The class consciousness of our tycoons is fragile. The threat that fortunes of such size inherently pose to democracy rightly preoccupies Alfani, though he comes to no firm conclusion about it. At the moment, the number of great fortunes and the difficulty of balancing their interests have made it difficult for an individual billionaire to exert influence over the rest. The donations of the super wealthy to the Republican Democratic parties, for instance, roughly cancel each other out. But that could change, which leaves the rest of us and the legacy of the anti-inequality movement in an anxious and contingent position. Instead of fighting a class war against the rich, we now find ourselves swimming with the whales. And now, from the Annals of Inquiry section of the May 13th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker, why we are turning psychiatric labels into identities. So you're on the spectrum, or you've got borderline personality disorder, or you're a sociopath. Once you're sure that's who you are, you've got a personal stake in this very creaky diagnostic system, by Manveer Singh. To name something, to separate it from the rest of existence and bestow a label on it, is a foundational act. It is the beginning of understanding and control. In Genesis, the first thing God did after splitting light from darkness was to call the light day and the darkness night. After Adam was created and let loose in the Garden of Eden, his original job was human label maker. God brought him creatures to see what he would name them, and whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. If Adam was like most people, he probably set about attaching names to natural kinds, groupings seemingly dictated by inherent features of the natural world. Referring to a group of animals as pigs, he would have assumed that the critters so designated all shared properties that differentiated them from every other non-pig animal. Psychologists say that we intuitively treat categorical distinctions, whether among fruits, emotions, or ethnic groups, as if, in Plato's famous metaphor, they carved nature at its joints. No sector of human activity is as serious about naming or as an intent on respecting natural kinds as science. Across centuries of debate and revisions, fields such as physics, chemistry, and biology have refined nomenclatures to better align with the natural order. Psychiatry, at first, looks like another success story. Years of research and clinical observation have yielded catalogs of presumed mental dysfunction, culminating in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. First produced by the American Psychiatric Association 7 decades ago, and currently in its 5th edition, the DSM organizes conditions into families such as anxiety disorders, sexual dysfunctions, and personality disorders. Each diagnosis is described by clear criteria and accompanied by a menu of information, including prevalence, risk factors, and comorbidities. Although clinicians and researchers have understood the DSM to be a work in progress, many had faith that the manual's categories would come to approximate natural kinds, exhibiting, as the Columbia psychiatry professor Gerald Maxman put it in 1985, specific genetic patterns, characteristic responses to drugs, and similar biological features. More than any other document, the DSM guides how Americans and, to a lesser extent, people worldwide understand and deal with mental illness. It decrees psychiatric vocabulary, having codified terms like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder. It determines which conditions are taught in medical schools, which can be treated by FDA-approved drugs, and which allow people to collect disability benefits and insurance reimbursements. Through its classification of mental illnesses, it establishes their prevalence in the population and indicates which ones public policy should target. The DSM, as we know it, appeared in 1980 with the publication of the DSM-3. Whereas the first 2 editions featured broad classifications and a psychoanalytic perspective, the DSM-3 favored more precise diagnostic criteria and a more scientific approach. Proponents hoped that research in genetics and neuroscience would corroborate the DSM's groupings. Almost half a century later, however, the emerging picture is of overlapping conditions, of categories that blur rather than stand apart. No disorder has been tied to a specific gene or set of genes. Nearly all genetic vulnerabilities implicated in mental illness have been associated with many conditions. A review of more than 500 fMRI studies of people engaged in specific tasks found that although brain imaging can detect indicators of mental illness, it fails to distinguish between schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, and other conditions. The DSM's approach to categorization increasingly looks arbitrary and anachronistic. Stephen Hyman, who directed the National Institute of Mental Health from 1996 to 2001, told the Times that he considered the manual an absolute scientific nightmare. In 2009, 4 leaders of the DSM-5 revision wrote about their hopes to update our classification to recognize the most prominent syndromes that are actually present in nature. The outcome didn't live up to those aspirations. In April 2013, weeks before the DSM-5's slated release, Thomas Insel, Then the director of the NIMH remarked, "The final product involves mostly modest alterations of the previous edition." As a result, he announced the Institute will be reorienting its research away from DSM categories. In DSM, A History of Psychiatry's Bible, published in 2021, the medical sociologist Alan V. Horvitz presents reasons for the DSM-5's botched revolution, including infighting among members of the working groups and the sidelining of clinicians during the revision process. But there's a larger difficulty. Revamping the DSM requires destroying kinds of people. As the philosopher Ian Hacking observed, labeling people is very different from labeling quarks or microbes. Quarks and microbes are indifferent to their labels. By contrast, human classifications change how individuals experience themselves and may even lead people to evolve their feelings and behavior in part because they are so classified. Hacking's best-known example is multiple personality disorder. Between 1972 and 1986, the number of cases of patients with multiple personalities exploded from the double digits to an estimated 6,000. Whatever one's thoughts about the reality of multiple personality disorder, he observed, everyone could agree that in 1955, this was not a way to be a person. No such diagnosis existed. By 1986, though, multiple personality disorder was not only a recognized psychiatric label, it was also sanctioned by academics, popular books, talk shows, and, most important, the experiences of people with multiple personalities. Hacking referred to this process in which naming creates the thing named, and which the meaning of names can be affected, in turn, by the name bearers as dynamic nominalism. Three new books, Paige Lael's But Everyone Feels This Way, How an Autism Diagnosis Saved My Life, Patrick Gagne's Sociopath, A Memoir, and Alexander Criss's Borderline, The Biography of a Personality Disorder, illustrate how psychiatric classification shapes the people it describes. It models social identities. It offers scripts for how to behave and explanation for one's interior life. By promising to tell people who they really are, diagnosis produces personal stakes in the diagnostic system, fortifying it against upheaval. Just as personality tests, see, I'm an introvert, astrological signs, I'm a Libra, and generational monikers, I'm a Gen Z, are used to aid self-understanding, so are psychiatric diagnoses. When Paige Lael was 15, a psychiatrist told her that she had autism spectrum disorder. She describes the rush of clarity she experienced when hearing the DSM-5 criteria. I'm not crazy. I'm not making it up. I'm not manipulative or trying to fake anything. There's a reason why I'm the way that I am. Lael's diagnosis and her discovery that so many of my questions have one clear answer comes halfway through her book. The chapters leading up to it recount the frustration and confusion of being inexplicably different. She lists her traits early on, picking at her skin, pulling out her hair, cutting tags from her clothes, disassociating at the sound of fireworks. By the first grade, she says, she could read almost as well as a sixth grader, and in later years, she consistently earned high marks. Yet, she failed to decipher implicit meanings of texts in English class. She also struggled with anxiety. She was, in her words, the weird kid who cried all the time and was so stressed that she wanted to die every single day. In 2020, she posted a video on TikTok slamming a trend that used autistic to mean dumb. It went viral. With a bluntness easily mistaken for vanity, she told the camera, "Hi there, I'm autistic. I'm also the smartest person I've ever met. Okay?" In the years since, she has become one of the most popular autism awareness activists on the platform. attracting more than 2.5 million followers. Bubbly and socially perceptive, with expertly applied makeup and a way of looking into the camera that's both intimate and intense, she defies common expectations of what an autistic person looks like, while also delivering a message about the diversity of autism's expressions and especially its different presentations in men and women. Some organizations and style guides now urge what is called person-first language, example, person with autism, over diagnosis-first language, example, autistic person. These recommendations are straight-up basic ableism. Lael writes in her book, I am autistic, I am always autistic, in every situation, all of the time, 24/7. I would be a completely different person if I wasn't autistic, and the idea of who that person would be is something I could never figure out, because autism is such an integral part of my identity. To take it away would be to take all of me away, and I find it ableist to want to try. What it means to be autistic, however, is constantly in flux. Over the past 20 years, the prevalence of autism in the United States has quadrupled, according to the CDC, Center for Disease Control. A major driver of this surge has been a broadening of the definition and a lowering of the diagnostic threshold. Among people diagnosed with autism, an international meta-analysis in JAMA Psychiatry found, evidence of the psychological and neurological traits associated with the condition declined by up to 80% between 2000 and 2015. Although many celebrate the expansion of autism as better characterizing its many varieties, leading researchers such as Laurent Montron and Uta Frith worry that the heterogeneity dilutes a natural category. Temple Grandin, the academic and autism spokesperson, told The Observer in 2022, the spectrum is so broad it doesn't make much sense. Lael's autism is likely a product of this expansion. Her psychiatrist told her that, had she visited a couple of years earlier, he would have diagnosed her with Asperger's syndrome, not autism. But one of the few big changes implemented between the DSM-4 and the DSM-5 was the collapse of pervasive developmental disorders, including Asperger's, into autism spectrum disorder. The act that Lael considers such a violation, being deprived of her diagnosis and thus her identity, was inflicted on the entirety of the Asperger's community. What's more, many people once diagnosed as having Asperger's learn that, under the new criteria, they would not qualify as having autism spectrum disorder. The change caused fear and confusion, and for some, felt like a denial of nature itself. It surprises me that they'd remove that label when it's very clearly something that exists, a British man formerly diagnosed as having Asperger's told the psychologist Bethan Chambers. I'm now a member of an endangered species. The erasure of Asperger's offers a glimpse into what a larger diagnostic revolution might herald. The term was coined in 1981 and first appeared in the DSM-4 in 1994. Thriving communities soon developed around the label, including Aspies for Freedom, an online group that had close to 50,000 members in 2013. Individuals with Asperger's led the opposition to a unified autism diagnosis. Once they failed and it became clear that the new manual would not only remove Asperger's syndrome, but also deprive many former Aspies of a place on the spectrum, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network successfully lobbied the DSM-5, Neurodevelopmental Disorders Working Group, to broaden the diagnostic criteria and allow people with previous Asperger's diagnoses to be recognized as autistic. A community created by a label sought to keep that label alive and, barring that, to maintain their inclusion in the system writ large. But Everyone Feels This Way is a heartfelt, vulnerable book about understanding and accepting autism in a world that constantly demands normalcy. At the same time, it hinges on the disorder being as it is presented in the DSM-5, both a spectrum and a natural kind, wildly various but biologically grounded. I hope that, with knowledge and technology continuously improving in the science world, neurologists and other experts on neurodevelopment will eventually be the ones diagnosing ASD, not psychiatrists basing their diagnosis on arbitrary actions, Lael writes. Yet, the same research threatens to destabilize the spectrum and her place on it. Like Lael, Patrice Gagné noticed that something was off as a child. By the age of 7, she had a box full of stolen trinkets. When a classmate invited her over for a slumber party, she left after everyone else fell asleep and walked the streets of San Francisco. Around the age of 9, she locked 2 girls out of her house after one of them told Gagné, "Your house sucks and so do you." Gagné stabbed her in the head with a number 2 pencil. The girl survived. Emotions such as anger and happiness came easily, she writes in Sociopath, a memoir, but empathy and guilt, embarrassment and jealousy were like a language I couldn't speak or understand. During her first year at UCLA, Gagné says she started stealing cars, which meant persuading drunk boys at frat parties to lend her their keys, going on nighttime joyrides, and then returning the cars before morning. It was around that time, she writes, that she first understood the meaning of sociopath through an introduction to psychology class. The professor described sociopaths as people prone to apathy who behave badly out of a desperation to feel something. The concept clicked for Gagné. "I'd always longed for some sort of evidence that I wasn't alone. Validation that I wasn't the only person in the world who didn't feel things like everyone else," she writes. "I'd always suspected, but now I knew for sure. There were enough people like me to justify an entire psychological category." But sociopathy isn't a psychological category, at least not diagnostically. The first edition of the DSM included sociopathic personality disturbance, a grouping that spanned callous lawbreakers, sexual deviants, and people with substance abuse problems. The term sociopathic was dropped from the DSM-2 with the arrival of antisocial personality disorder, even as the word remained popular outside clinical diagnoses. Some scholars associated sociopathy with remorseless and impulsive behavior caused by a brain injury. Other people associated it with an antisocial personality. In The Sociopath Next Door, published in 2005, the psychologist Martha Stout used it to mean a lack of conscience. Gagné, for her part, positioned sociopathy as something real but missing from the DSM, a stand-in for her own categorically confounding antisocialness. Of course, trusting a self-professed sociopath can be tricky. "The story you are about to read is true," she declares in the preface, before admitting in the introduction, "I'm a liar," and describing herself as highly manipulative. Her credibility feels especially thin when she talks about scholarship. Despite many mentions of "my doctorate" and "my research," her book never cites that research. It hardly ever cites other researchers either. Her academic credentials have been a matter of public scrutiny, with both Redditors and a recent Times reviewer pointing to the unavailability of her dissertation online. She does have a doctoral degree and did complete a dissertation, but I couldn't locate any published papers by her in the usual databases. If we take her at her word, though, she exists in a psychiatric purgatory. She only half identifies with antisocial personality disorder as it is presented in the DSM-4. When a therapist screens her using the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, Her score is higher than average, but not high enough to qualify her as a psychopath. She also violates many popular assumptions about antisocial people. "I don't care what other people think," she says, before describing how she longed for her mother's approval. She says that love doesn't come naturally, yet talks about it extensively, mostly in connection with her husband, David, but also to describe her feelings toward her mother, her father, her sister, and a ferret named Baby. "I'm not interested in morals," she announces on the first page. A few chapters later, she says that she set a rule of no hurting anybody as a teenager. These contradictions sit at the heart of Gagne's memoir. She craves diagnosis and uses clinical labels as a framework for self-understanding, but the fit is always awkward and the implications are disheartening. "I don't want to feel like things like relationships and love and family are out of reach just because I don't internalize emotions the same way everybody else does," she says at one point. Confronted with the failure of existing schemes to explain her distress, she sees not a broken system, but a space for a new diagnosis of her own devising, sociopathic spectrum disorder. To be named is to be acknowledged, to be situated in a natural order. If Gagne's sociopathy falls outside DSM diagnoses, borderline personality cuts across them. A condition of volatility, borderline personality disorder is identified by sudden swings in mood, self-image, and perceptions of others. Patients with BPD tend to have intense, unstable relationships and often describe an agonizingly raw sensitivity. The psychologist Marcia Linen has compared BPD to a psychological third-degree burn. Even the slightest touch or movement can create immense suffering. BPD's nebulous nature is encoded in its name. The concept is generally attributed to the psychoanalyst Adolf Stern, who used it in 1937 to describe patients who were neither neurotic nor psychotic, and thus borderline. The committee charged with designing measures for personality disorders for the DSM-3 discussed its confusing status when debating its inclusion. Some members noted that key symptoms, such as identity disturbance, outbursts of anger, and unstable interpersonal relations, also featured in narcissistic and histrionic personality disorders. During the internal deliberations, Donald Klein, then a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, complained that every conceivable variety of character disorder has been described as borderline at one time or another. In Personality Disorders, A Short History of Narcissistic, Borderline, Antisocial, and Other Types, published in 2023, Alan Horvitz, the medical sociologist, asks why the DSM still treats BPD as a disorder of personality rather than of mood. Its trademark indicator, emotional dysregulation, is virtually the opposite of the rigidity that characterizes a PD, a personality disorder, he writes. Alexander Criss, in Borderline, the Biography of a Personality Disorder, embraces the categorical quagmire. A psychotherapist and a professor of psychology at Fordham University, Criss takes an expansive view of borderline personality disorder, finding traces of it in Hippocratic writings about hysteria, early modern accusations of witchcraft, and a range of diagnostic categories, including complex PTSD. His book is eerie, lyrical, and erudite, fitting for a man who, as we learn, switched to clinical psychology from playwriting, and who seems more interested in Freudian theories than in modern psychiatric constructs. He prefers not to make declarative statements about the nature of borderline personality disorder, choosing instead to study it through others' attempts to name, treat, and demonize psychological instability. He's openly contemptuous of the DSM. By distancing itself from its psychoanalytical roots, he says, the manual abandoned useful insights about etiology and treatment and about psychological mechanisms like splitting and projection. He also condemns its categorical approach to illness, which he thinks poorly represents reality. A disease was a disease because the book said it was a disease, he writes, comparing the DSM's institutional authority to religious scripture. Perhaps it is time to reject the naming of things once and for all, he suggests at one point, to at least consider the possibility of leaving the world of categories behind. Chris recognizes how the process of labeling reifies categories, especially in the age of the Internet. Online communities crystallize psychiatric tags into identities to be socially accommodated and invite people to diagnose themselves. Such communities, Chris fears, can pervert borderline personality disorder into a self-serving justification for misconduct. He cites the musician Abby Weems' post about her relationship with the podcaster Dustin Marshall. Quote, he made it so easy to rationalize his behavior, telling me that's just what happens when someone has borderline personality disorder. His personality disorder made up so much of his identity that any abusive behavior fell under the umbrella of his condition. End quote. What's more striking is that Chris, for all his misgivings, doesn't just diagnose patients as having the disorder. He also advertises himself as someone who specializes in borderline personality disorder. The market demands it, he says. You need to be known for knowing something, and people presumably look up therapists proficient with existing DSM labels. Even as I was discovering that being borderline was not so special, that it was common and somehow related to the human condition, including my own, I wanted people to see me as an expert, he reflects. Despite his exceptional resistance to the DSM, Chris, like his patients, finds himself inhabiting its categories. If the existing taxonomy is such a mess, what would a better diagnostic system look like? In 2015, following the disappointment that greeted the release of the DSM-5, three psychologists formed a consortium to build one. Two of them, David Watson and Robert Kruger, had been involved in the revision of the DSM. A third, Roman Kotov, was a young researcher who sensed that the profession would be grateful for a different system. 2 years later, they and 37 other researchers, including Stephen Hyman, the former National Institute of Mental Health director, published a proposal for a new approach to classifying mental illness. They called it the Hierarchical Taxonomy of Psychopathology, or HITOP, HITOP. The taxonomy sets aside existing diagnoses and starts by asking what goes with what. Symptoms and traits that occur together constitute syndromes, and so on, up the hierarchy, giving rise to subfactors, spectra, and superspectra. Everything is measured continuously. The taxonomy consists of dimensions rather than categories. The result is a provisional scheme of up to 6 spectra, including internalizing, which covers symptoms of anxiety and depression, externalizing, which splits into disinhibition and antagonism, and thought disorder, which encompasses psychotic and some bipolar symptoms. The creators of HITOP claim that it overcomes some of the biggest issues of the DSM. It embraces continua rather than black and white entities. It avoids the wild heterogeneity of some disorders. It results in fewer patients like Gagne who experience dysfunction yet struggle to meet the criteria for any disorder. They also say that it fits better with findings from the fields of genetics and neuroscience. HITOP has garnered an enormous amount of excitement. In just 7 years, the article presenting the system has been cited nearly 3,000 times. The consortium, meanwhile, has expanded more than fourfold. As the hype has grown, so has criticism. Detractors argue that a taxonomy designed using superficial commonalities is still a long way from mapping the nature of psychopathology. They also point out that HITOP draws partly from self-reports of symptoms, which can be unreliable, and suggests that Whatever its lofty claims, it has replaced one set of abstractions with another. Yet there's a broader issue here. People's symptoms frequently evolve according to the labels they've been given. Following Lael's visit to the psychiatrist, her mother observed, "You've been acting more and more autistic since we got the diagnosis." Lael took the comment as a sign that her mom didn't understand her. "I hate it when someone thinks I'm a liar," she writes. But people everywhere encounter models of illness that they unconsciously embody. Some instances are subtle, others are dramatic and startling. In 2006, a student at a Mexican boarding school developed devastating leg pain and had trouble walking. Soon, hundreds of classmates were afflicted. A 15th century German nun started biting her companions. Eventually, the strange hysteria infected convents from Holland to Italy. Ian Hacking, the philosopher, argued that such a dynamic fueled the epidemic of multiple personality disorder in the late 20th century, and something similar seems to be playing out now with the growing portrayal of dissociative identity disorder, the current name for multiple personality disorder, on social media. One of Chris's patients, a student who went by Haku, developed a multiplicity of selves after being introduced to the concept of dissociative identity disorder. "It's not that I thought he was faking it," Chris recalls. "It seemed more that Haku wanted to have multiple personalities, even if that meant he had to force himself and others to believe in it." Any new psychiatric taxonomy develops in the shadow of the old. It must contend with the echoes of the previous scheme, with people whose selves have been cast in the shape of their former classification. By failing to take these into account, models such as Hightop risk recreating the categories of their predecessors. Psychiatric diagnosis, wrapped in scientific authority and tinged with essentialist undertones, offers a potent script. As Lael wondered after she was told about her autism, "How did I know what was truly me and what I had convinced myself I was?" Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.